Welcome to the Science Podcast for March 22nd, 2013. I'm Sarah Crespi.
And I'm Carrie Klein. This week, locomotion over unstable ground, mapping health, and challenges ahead for ethanol-based fuels.
Let's say we project ourselves forward to 2022, where there's 36 billion gallons of renewable fuels being pushed onto the market. Where is all that going to go?
Plus, a few stories from our online daily news site.
Support for the Science Podcast is provided by AAAS, the American Association for the Advancement of Science. AAAS, the Science Society, at www.aaas.org.
Granular materials are aggregates of particles that behave individually as solids, but en masse, they flow and resolidify in response to applied forces. A common example is plain old sand, and its unique properties are the reason why we spend nearly as much time moving backwards as forwards while walking along the beach. But there are animals that move effortlessly over granular terrains. Daniel Goldman and his colleagues argue that studying how they move may inform the physics and biology of locomotion over unstable ground. I spoke with Goldman, who began by explaining how he got involved in such a specialized field of research.
Ever since I was a kid, I've been very interested in lizards and small animals and how they move around. And my PhD work was done on the physics of granular materials, how they go from solid states to fluid states. As I moved along my academic trajectory, I realized that there are a number of animals which move around on and within these kind of loose materials in the natural world, including little lizards that swim through sand in the desert and little rodents that hop over sand.
And haven't engineers already studied how bodies move through this kind of material? You know, we have dune buggies and we have certain vehicles that work better in sandy terrains.
Yeah, that's an interesting point. There is a branch of engineering called terra mechanics, which has been around since the 40s, 50s, whose goal is to predict large wheeled and treaded tracked vehicles' performance over loose, deformable materials like sand, snow, mud. And it does a pretty good job in predicting how much force it takes to move through the material and how much the vehicle will sink. But we and other experts who we consulted have been unable to figure out how to apply it to the kind of small-legged devices and small-legged locomotors like little lizards, which are 10, 15 centimeters long, that move dynamically and rapidly over these loose materials like sand and rubble.
Right. So how exactly does a lizard move in sand, and how did that inform your methodology for this study?
Really, we don't know yet how all lizards move in sand. We've studied in detail a couple animals, including a lizard, which is called a zebra-tailed lizard, which lives in the Mojave Desert of the southwest United States. And it happens to be about 10, 15 centimeters long, and has legs, which are also pretty long, and has toes, which are about as long as its legs. And these toes, we found in previous work, enable it to sort of bounce over hard ground, but also function as paddles to move it through sand. That's just one example. We've studied little hatchling sea turtles as they transit from their nest down to the beach at speeds of 3 body lengths per second. And we find that they don't rely on a kind of paddling motion through the sand, but instead they put their little flipper in and they solidify the sand around them and push off little solid starting blocks. So we decided for this study to focus not on the animals at first blush, because they're simply too complicated. Mm. They have too many moving parts and their bodies can deform. And we decided to focus on what researchers in this field of bio and neuromechanics are increasingly using. We started to focus on physical models, little robot models. And so we basically adapted a toy robot for our purposes by taking out all of its guts and replacing it with stronger motors and 3D printing some interesting leg shapes and running this robot over a controlled test bed of granular material. In this case, it happened to be little poppy seeds, but we found similar results on other kinds of granular materials, including sand.
Can you describe some of the different shapes of legs that you used?
Yeah, so we decided that we should just go for broke and vary limbs in a controlled way as widely as we could. So a limb which has become pretty popular among legged robotics researchers is something that basically looks like a C.
Like the letter C.
Yes, correct, like the letter C. The robot we studied happens to have 6 of those C-shaped legs, and it moves them in kind of a cockroach fashion, meaning three legs go at once, and then the next three go, and the next three go, and they kind of rotate in circles. And we printed C-shaped legs and C-shaped legs with less curvature, and we've printed flat legs, and then we even reversed the leg shape so that the C, the open part of the C, would hit the ground first, thinking that perhaps that would help the robot claw through the sand.
And so which one of these ended up actually moving the most effectively?
Well, it turns out that our engineering collaborators who picked the original C knew what they were doing. Something that looked very close to a perfect C, but not exactly a perfect C. The convex leg seemed to be the leg which allowed the robot to generate the most lift to keep itself high out of the ground and also to generate a lot of thrust to push itself forward at each step.
And why would that be? What are all the forces interacting here to make that happen?
Yeah, so this goes back to the other part of the story, which was really, I'd say, the largest part of the work in this study. And I want to say that all of this work was done by a former student in my lab, Chen Li, who's now a postdoc at UC Berkeley, and a student doing theory and computation, Tingnan Zhang. And those are the two who really kind of pushed this forward. And we wanted to understand the performance of this robot. We wanted to be able to predict this performance of this robot, and we wanted to be able to do it without resorting to a theory or a model with many fitting parameters. That's a word one often hears in predictive modeling. And so we got an idea by looking at the X-ray video of the robot's legs intruding into the sand that we could think of the robot's legs, and this is the kind of key insight, as not sort of continuous pieces of material, but instead of as lots of little plate elements kind of formed in the shape of that leg, whatever that shape may be, and instantaneously each little plate element is moving through the material with a particular depth and orientation and angle of movement. And we got the idea, based on some of our earlier work modeling the swimming of a little lizard in sand, that if we simply took those plate elements and were able to measure the forces on each of those plate elements and then sum those plate element forces up, we might get a good estimate of the net force on each leg and any body segment intersecting the sand. The problem is, to do this procedure, this linear superposition procedure, one needs to know the forces on individual plate elements, and we didn't have those because they're not available from Terra Mechanics, and there's no comprehensive theory of granular materials yet which could give us those essential force relationships. So what Chen Li did is he basically took a plate, and he intruded it into the granular material at different attack angles and different movement directions, and he did that for every attack angle and movement direction he could, and measured the forces as these little plates intruded to different depths, and basically got relations that could tell us instantaneously any element on the robot's C-shaped leg, what force that little element would experience if it's moving with a particular orientation and direction. And he didn't just do that for one granular material. He did it for small glass particles, about a third of a millimeter in size. He did it for glass particles which are a factor of 10 larger, 3-millimeter glass particles. He did that for loosely packed states of these materials and compacted states of these materials. And the sort of first surprise was that he could sum up the plate elements, and he got a very good estimate of the forces on the robot's leg, the kind of dead leg experiments we called them.
That's an attractive name for it.
Well, the robot's not alive anyway, so you know, we'll come up with something better.
So, all right, so you've created then, you know, a small robot that can very effectively move through different kinds of granular media. You know, more practically, what are the applications of not only this little device, but all of this cataloging that you've done?
Right. So I would first answer the cataloging question. Had the catalog turned out to be just that, you have to go to every granular material and come up with a different set of force relationships for flat plates, I think that would have been useful, but from a physicist's point of view, which I'm a physicist, not particularly satisfying because there's no generality in there. It turned out that Chen and Tingnan noticed that all of the stress profiles they measured sort of looked the same. They kind of had the same shape if you looked at them as a three-dimensional surface. And what they then realized was that they could take that function and essentially scale it by the force it takes to just push an object straight down into sand, which then allow you to compute to a reasonable accuracy the forces on complex shaped intruders into those materials.
Hmm.
Now, in terms of more general aspects for locomotion studies, you know, we call this terradynamics to distinguish it from terramechanics in the sense that we've been inspired by aerodynamics and hydrodynamics, and we think a terradynamics is kind of a scientific approach to understanding movement on flowing terrestrial ground, like sand, and we hope even more complicated ground, like lunar regolith and Martian soil and all these interesting complicated materials. So we think that this kind of approach can help, as a practical way, engineers design devices to move through these materials and understand the forces that these materials exert on such devices. Biologically, and that's where I'm really interested, we think that by having these kind of relationships, it allows biologists to understand why particular organisms have certain limb shapes that they do, why evolution has selected particular shapes of limbs, and also to understand the performance of organisms in the environments that they live in.
Great. Well, Dan Goldman, thanks so much.
My pleasure. Thank you very much.
Daniel Goldman and colleagues write about locomotion over granular material in a report this week.
Using search term frequency, Google is able to show trends in flu cases and dengue fever by location almost in real time. But Google doesn't have a monopoly on geospatial health data. In a perspective this week, Douglas Richardson and colleagues discuss new approaches to using GPS and geographic information systems to integrate health, environmental, social, and genetic data in new ways.
Several of us from the geography and geoscience communities, as well as the health research communities, have been looking at what we call spatializing health research. Most health research has yet to take full advantage of the latest developments in geospatial data collection, analysis, and modeling, or of the opportunities to develop large-scale integrated health-related spatial data infrastructures for better understanding the prevalence, causes, transmission, and treatment of diseases. As health researchers have gained access to ever more detailed and sophisticated genetic and epigenetic information, there is now a growing counter-demand for similarly more detailed and precise information about the genetic interactions with the environment and social contexts of health and disease. That's where geography, with its emphasis on place and spatial relationships, and geographic information science, with its capacity to integrate and correlate vast amounts of detailed environmental data, both spatially and temporally, with observed health conditions such as infectious diseases, cancer, obesity, mental illness, and addiction, are becoming central to medical research that aims to address complex genetic environmental interactions, as well as to obtain detailed exposure information about environmental and social risks.
So with all of these advances in tracking, mapping, data mining, researchers have been able to tease apart some really interesting relationships. Can you give us a few examples of the use of these new spatial methods in the evaluation of, say, environmental or social risk?
Yes, the use of GPS and GIS together, Global Positioning System and Geographic Information Systems, allows researchers to obtain very detailed exposure data regarding risks, whether they're carcinogens or whether they're access to social environments such as liquor stores and so forth. Typically, exposure research has used broad areas, such as the county of the residence, etc., to try to make spatial correlations. With data-intensive GPS-GIS technologies, one can follow a subject's pathways to work, to other places. You get a much more detailed location-based assessment of risks, both because you're looking at the movements of the subject and you're looking at the variations in the social context or the environmental risks involved. That has really revolutionized, in many ways, the ability to get highly detailed exposure data at the individual as well as the aggregate level.
Mm-hmm. So let's talk about some specific diseases that you bring up in your article, such as HIV and malaria. How has this approach proved useful in monitoring those diseases?
Geographic information systems, visualization, and analytical tools are enabling researchers to identify spatial patterns and to model specific processes of disease diffusion or contagion, such as pandemic influenza viruses or evolving genetic strains of HIV, hepatitis, or tuberculosis. Researchers have integrated patient demographics, daily activities, and HIV viral concentrations to map and model changing spatial patterns of HIV infections and their relationships to health care treatment programs or to social risk factors. We've also been using GIS data, spatial statistics, and interactive mapping to identify HIV concentration hotspots near the Mexican-U.S. border. And a group of researchers from the University of San Diego are leading that effort. This kind of GIS-based analysis enables proactive and timely delivery of tailored prevention and treatment strategies such as HIV testing, antiretroviral therapy intervention, and education to the affected communities.
You also mentioned real-time tracking from volunteers, crowdsourcing data. What kind of information can be gleaned from this method?
Yeah, these activities are evolving rapidly. They're fairly new, although what's been called participatory GIS is about 10 or 15 years old. So these activities are variously referred to as participatory GIS, crowdsourcing, or volunteer geographic information. For example, by analyzing data from 15 million mobile phone subscribers, Weslowski et al. Examined the complex interactions between human and animal movements and the spread of malaria in Kenya. And from Japan to California, volunteers with GPS-enabled real-time air quality monitoring systems are assessing exposures to air pollution and to radiation at spatial resolution levels and data densities not previously feasible.
So we now have a lot of data coming in at a very large scale, as you described, and these studies can show us how people move and interact. Does it suggest better designs or different kinds of interventions when you look at these kind of results?
Yes, it does. The density, the accuracy, the specificity of new geospatial data facilitates sophisticated spatial and temporal analysis and the modeling of spatial health processes at the level of the individual rather than the aggregate. Research based on such data-intensive real-time GPS GIS methods with miniaturized or wearable environmental and biomedical monitors is generating many advances in exposure assessment as well as in mobility and obesity studies, for example. So in addition to individual interventions from this research, it can also lead to outcomes such as the design of healthier environments, which enhance access to parks and quality foods, for example, and better treatment programs for a wide range of health conditions from asthma to diabetes.
Are there any problems with this approach for improving health or society in terms of, you know, privacy or other kinds of concerns like that?
You know, health research has always been concerned about confidentiality of data. So it's a research environment that's very sensitized to and respectful of the need for confidentiality and privacy with research subjects. We are very focused on that. In fact, the Association of American Geographers has a grant from the National Science Foundation to explore and to address the unique confidentiality risks of geospatial data. One of the reasons that there are unique confidentiality characteristics of geospatial data is that when you visualize it, you're basically creating a map. Mm-hmm. When you visualize most health data, whether statistical data and so forth, typically that visualization is a graph or a chart. But when you visualize geospatial data, the visualization typically is a map, which lends itself to recognition, even if it's not labeled and so mm-hmm. forth. There's a possibility for obtaining patterns of location that could identify subjects. So there are some unique risks. We're working closely with the Inter-University Consortium for Political and Social Research at the University of Michigan. We're working together with them to explore the use of what's called virtual data enclaves to enable sharing of this research data among researchers with confidentiality.
Okay. It's often the case that big data brings big problems. There are issues of storage, accessibility, and compatibility between data sets. Are there any frameworks in place now to help with managing all of this incoming information?
Yes. As I mentioned earlier, the AG has an initiative on developing what we call an NIH-wide geospatial infrastructure, which can mean many things. So we've been working with NIH for about a decade on many of these issues. And it's clear that better institutional and educational models for successfully integrating the spatial dimension into health research and practice are needed to achieve the full benefits of these capabilities in a timely manner. There is also an urgent need for the creation of distributed, interoperable spatial data infrastructures to integrate health research data across and within disparate research programs. In addition to fostering standards and scientific access, such large-scale spatial data infrastructures are themselves also powerful new resources for generating and testing hypotheses, detecting spatial patterns, and responding to health threats.
All right. Well, Douglas Richardson, thanks so much for talking with me.
It's a pleasure. Thank you so much.
Douglas Richardson and colleagues write about the potential for mapping health in A Perspective this week.
Nearly 30 years after its establishment, U.S. pharmaceutical patent policy is poised for a major review by the Supreme Court. Science's Meghna Sachdev spoke with Christopher Hempel, author of a policy forum this week, about the potential impact of a ruling on drug regulations. You can find the podcast on the Science site or download it from iTunes after Monday, March 25th. When ethanol-based fuel caught on in the United States, abundant, carbohydrate-rich corn crops were a go-to feedstock. But as supply, demand, and price have gotten more complicated, farmers and researchers have had to turn their attention to the non-edible parts of plants, producing what's known as cellulosic ethanol. Science News writer Bob Service talked with me about the state of the cellulosic ethanol industry, as well as the challenges that lie ahead.
Ethanol is actually already used as a fuel. So right now, if you go to the gas station and use the regular pump, that's E10. That means there's 10% ethanol and 90% gasoline. And you can just change the mixture. So if you want to, say, go to cellulosic ethanol, you can just enrich the amount of ethanol in that fuel mixture. So you can go to E15 or E20 or E85. So we already have cars in the United States that run on E85. Those are flex fuel vehicles. In Brazil, they actually have cars that run on 100% ethanol.
But the ethanol that we're talking about here is produced from corn and sugars.
That's correct. Those are the sources of commercial ethanol that's sold today. So the traditional technology as it grew up was ethanol made from sugar, and that technology has been around for thousands of years.
Mm-hmm.
So with corn is a more complex carbohydrate. So you'd take the corn starch, only the starch in the kernel of the corn, and you use some enzymes to chop up that starch into sugar, and then that gets fed to the yeast to then convert to ethanol.
So how do these fuels come into use in the United States in the first place?
Ethanol was actually used as a fuel in the U.S. before gasoline. So the Model T in 1908 was designed to use ethanol. But once they discovered gasoline and realized that it was a much more energy-rich source of hydrocarbons, the world turned to the use of gasoline and pretty much hasn't looked back ever since. That began to change in the United States in 2005. So at that point, the U.S. was spending more and more money importing gasoline and importing oil. And so Congress was trying to look for potential solutions for ways to start reducing that dependence. And so they introduced something called the Renewable Fuels Standard, the RFS for short. And what they envisioned back in 2005 was that they would require refiners and blenders that make the final mixtures of gasoline to blend in increasing volumes of renewable fuels. And these initially would be ethanol from corn and sugar, but later on they envisioned cellulosic ethanol as well as other advanced biofuels.
So where does cellulosic ethanol stand right now in terms of these EPA mandates?
Well, cellulosic ethanol is really at a hinge point in its development. The effort to make cellulosic ethanol and other cellulosic biofuels have been around for decades. But anytime you're talking about energy and the commercialization of energy, it all has to do with cost. If you can't compete with the cost of gasoline, then it just doesn't really make any sense to talk about the commercial development of any kind of fuel. So what we're seeing with cellulosic ethanol is it's right now getting to the point where it's close to the price of ethanol derived from corn and other sources. So that's a pretty impressive development.
Mm-hmm.
One of the results of that is that there are lots of commercial scale production facilities now being produced around the world. Companies that want to sell tens of millions of gallons a year per plant of these fuels.
But of course, cheap manufacturing of this kind of fuel is not the only variable here. And so what are the critics of cellulosic ethanol saying?
Well, the critics have several points. And just by way of background, when Congress instituted the RFS, they said beginning in 2010, we're going to have 100 million gallons of cellulosic ethanol, and we're going to ramp this up steadily. They gave the Environmental Protection Agency, or the EPA, the authority to change those mandates as needed. And EPA has had to do so because the companies that were trying to make cellulosic ethanol just weren't ready. They couldn't produce commercial scale initially. And so the EPA has had to cut those mandates way back. Nevertheless, they have continued to have small mandates through 2012 and now 2013 for cellulosic ethanol to continue to sort of keep pressure on the industry to develop these fuels and encourage the industry actually to develop the fuels. And so what the critics say is that those mandates are costing them money, so it's making gasoline more expensive. They also criticize the RFS as not working. It's not leading to the development of cellulosic fuels. And finally, they also say that the use of E15 and other higher ethanol blends can damage car engines. And so those are all criticisms that the industry is continuing to grapple with.
And much of this criticism is coming from the oil industry.
Yeah, that is true. If you sort of think about it just from a sheer economics point of view, the oil industry has already had to give up 10% of its market share to ethanol. So E10 is 10% ethanol, so that's 10% of the fuel that is no longer gasoline.
So some claim that the RFS, these fuel standards, have been unsuccessful so far, but many proponents of the ethanol industry really disagree with that. What's their response to this criticism?
Well, as you might expect, they are willing to respond to all of the charges that have been leveled against ethanol and cellulosic ethanol. They contend that ethanol is actually a story where progress is real and it's happening. So they say that the ethanol industry in the United States has already created 70,000 direct jobs, whereas many more indirect jobs on the order of hundreds of thousands. They say that the use of ethanol has been instrumental in helping to lower oil imports in this country from 60% of all oil used in the country in 2006 to 41% today. Now, mind you, there's a caveat that we had a big recession in there, and so some of that reduction would have happened anyway.
Right.
They also say that it's helped cut greenhouse gas emissions, the equivalent last year of taking 5.2 million cars off the road. And they also say that the continued use of ethanol in increasing amounts will continue the downward pressure on oil prices. There's been one estimate out there from researchers at Oak Ridge National Lab that suggests that implementing the RFS standards by 2022 will help save the United States $120 billion.
Wow.
And as for the engine studies, they also say those are funded by the oil companies themselves and that they are flawed. They also say that the E15 blend is the most studied fuel in the history of transportation fuels, which had to clear a whole bunch of hurdles through the Department of Energy and the EPA in order to get approved.
So if ethanol producers can get the incentives that they want, and if the EPA still supports the manufacturing of these fuels, what does the road ahead look like? Is it smooth sailing for cellulosic ethanol?
It's definitely not, particularly for the next year or two. 2013 and 2014 are going to be a really kind of a tricky time for the U.S. ethanol industry, because immediately what they face is something that insiders in the business call the blend wall. So the United States uses right now roughly on the order of 132 billion gallons of gasoline, right? So that's a big number. So 10% of that, which is what we have for E10, would be 13.2 billion gallons of ethanol. And so we already use that now, and that pretty much all comes from corn ethanol and sugar ethanol. And so let's say all these cellulosic ethanol plants start to produce billions and billions of gallons of ethanol. Where is all that going to go? Because refiners are not required today to sell E15 blends. So if they don't have to and the refiners choose not to do it, well, then what happens with all that ethanol? And what happens to the cellulosic companies that are trying to gain market share and produce all that ethanol? But down the road, there's other even bigger problems. So let's say we project ourselves forward to 2022, where there's 36 billion gallons of renewable fuels being pushed onto the market. In order for that all that fuel to have somewhere to go, you're going to have higher blends than E15. You're going to need an E20, an E25 kind of a blend. Mm-hmm. And for that, you actually can't just use regular gasoline engines. You have to begin to make modifications to gasoline engines. That's very doable. I mean, like we talked about before, Brazil does that already. So the technology is out there, but it costs more money. And so you've got to get car companies to make that, and then you've got to get refiners and blenders to send that out to the distributors, to all the gas stations to sell it. It's a real classic chicken and the egg problem. So car makers don't want to make the engines unless they know that the fuel supply is going to be there. And the fuel makers don't want to make the fuel supply unless they know the cars are going to be there.
Right.
And so then you've got a question about, well, how are we going to sort this out? Now, there are efforts to solve some of these problems. There are efforts within some of the national labs, like the National Renewable Energy Lab, to bring refiners and car makers and all these different communities together to try to sort through the timelines. There are efforts to try to educate gas station owners to help them feel confident and encouraged to sell E15. And so it's just going to be a question as to whether or not those efforts are successful in time to take the fuel that is coming from the cellulosic ethanol companies.
Right. Well, Bob Service, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Bob Service writes about cellulosic ethanol's battle for the barrel in a News Focus in this week's issue.
Finally today, David Grimm, online news editor for Science, is here to give us a rundown of some of the recent stories from our daily news site. I'm Sarah Crespi. So, Dave, first up we have evolution via roadkill.
Sarah, this is one of those cool stories of actually kind of watching evolution in action. It deals with a group of birds called cliff swallows, and particularly a population that lives in southwestern Nebraska. Now, these birds, they make these mud nests on bridges or overpasses for pretty busy roads. So you can imagine that could be a problem for the birds. They fly out of their nest, and all of a sudden they are right in the face of oncoming traffic. And a couple that's been studying these birds for 30 years has actually noticed a lot of roadkill, specifically the cliff swallow roadkill on some of these roads under these overpasses.
That's what I liked about the story, actually, is it's a fortuitous discovery. They said, where did all the roadkill go?
You were right, because what they were seeing over time was they were seeing less and less roadkill. And they said, why are fewer of these birds being killed? The traffic was pretty much the same. The population of the birds was actually larger, so it wasn't actually like the population was going down. But for some reason, there was less roadkill than before.
And so after they did the body count, what did they do?
Well, what they did was when they did the body count, they actually started looking at the size of the wings of these birds that had been killed. And what they noticed, which was really interesting, was that birds with larger wings were more frequently ending up as roadkill than birds with shorter wings. And over time, the living birds, the wingspan had actually grown shorter over the 3 decades the researchers had been studying them.
And so they know that the shortest wingspan is an average over the population, and they know that fewer are dying in car accidents.
Right.
So how do they relate those two things, though?
Well, what it turns out is other studies have shown that the shorter a bird's wingspan, the more maneuverable they are in flight, the more able they are to do quick turns, which is something you'd want to do if you're about to get smacked by a car. So their speculation is that the cars are basically acting like natural selection. There are a selection on this population that birds with wings that are too long, that are not as maneuverable, are more likely to get hit by car. They're being weeded out of the population. They're not producing offspring. And only the birds with shorter wings that are much more maneuverable are surviving. Over the years, you have this population that is getting shorter and shorter wingspans.
Well, this makes me really curious about what other animals are being affected by cars.
Well, right, because, you know, we often think natural selection. We don't think human selection, but this is clearly a case, or seems to be a case, of human-caused selection. There's other factors like this that have impacts on birds, wind turbines, even glass windows, which is one of the leading causes, if not the leading cause, of bird deaths around the world. What impacts are these having on bird populations? And what impacts are other human activities having on other animal populations around the globe? Studies like this may start to reveal that.
And we might get some very, very smart deer down the road.
Right.
All right. Well, next up, we have some results from a malaria vaccine trial.
Right, and they're not very good results. This is a vaccine that's called RTS-S. It's not the most user-friendly vaccine name. It's actually an abbreviation of some of the protein components of the vaccine. Now, this vaccine was developed in the late 1980s, and it's actually the first malaria vaccine that's ever been tested in a phase 3 clinical trial. It looked pretty promising at first. In 2011, researchers reported that it cut rates of malaria by half in toddlers, and especially in areas like Africa where malaria is a huge problem. There's lots and lots of deaths every year. Something that could cut the rates of malaria in half is a huge deal.
So what's the news here?
Well, the news here isn't as good. It shows that the vaccine is either not working as well as researchers thought or just not working as long as researchers thought. This new study is a sort of a follow-up from one of the clinical trials that was going on. The researchers were following 450 children in Kenya, and the results revealed that 223 of the kids who received the vaccine, their protection faded over time. It was almost completely gone after 4 years.
Does this mean that this vaccine is no good, is no use anymore?
Well, not necessarily. It's just not as good as researchers thought. What they say is that because so many children get malaria in the region and many get it multiple times, they calculated that for every 100 children vaccinated, 65 cases of malaria were prevented. That means that the vaccine is not as good as researchers thought, but it's still doing something. And when you have so many children, especially dying, researchers are sort of grasping at straws and they want to use something that works, even if it doesn't work that great. The hope is that they'll use this in the short term. And in the meantime, researchers may develop a better vaccine or a vaccine that works well in combination with this vaccine that will much improve protection rates.
Great. All right. Well, last up, we have a story on a giant and mysterious sea creature.
Right. This is the giant squid. These are deep ocean creatures that can weigh hundreds of kilograms, measure more than 10 meters from their posterior fin to the tips of their two long tentacles. A living giant squid hadn't even been photographed till 2002. So these are very mysterious creatures. This new study is really shedding some light on their genetics. It turns out really remarkably that even though these giant squid live various places around the globe, they all constitute a single species, and they're all very highly related to each other.
So they actually collected samples from all these different squid. What did they do to those samples?
Right, and the samples actually came from some pretty unusual places. They found some of them were from stranded animals. Some of them were captured by trawlers. Some were even discovered in the stomach of a sperm whale, which is the only predator giant squids actually face. And what they found was they looked at the mitochondria of these animals, and they found almost no genetic differences between individuals. The mitochondrial genome has more than 20,000 base pairs, the sort of the letters we associate with DNA, and they only saw differences in 181 of these places over the 43 specimens they looked at.
So you're seeing very few changes in the DNA of the mitochondria. What does that mean about the history of these species?
Well, the researchers aren't really sure what it means. What they say is it means that all individuals of this species are very highly related. One possibility is that there was a so-called genetic bottleneck that happened. And this is basically when you have a very large population that's shrunk into just a few individuals. And because these few individuals are the only ones that left that are breeding, over time you have a lot of individuals that are basically related to that founder population of individuals, and everybody sort of looks the same, at least genetically.
If they went through a bottleneck, did the scientists have any idea about what caused that?
They don't seem to know what caused the bottleneck. What they speculate is that after this bottleneck occurred, the population exploded again. And that is because the whaling industry knocked out so many sperm whales that the giant squid were able to recover. But what's interesting is that the whaling industry, that's only been happening for a couple centuries. And when the researchers looked at the DNA, they can actually do something called a molecular clock, which tells them when some of these genetic changes may have occurred. And they're suggesting that the population expanded 30,000 to 700,000 years ago, which is way before we were whaling the
waters. Yeah, I don't think we had much to do with that.
So it really, you know, a lot of the studies we cover, we sort of answer questions. This study, it really only almost seems to produce questions. You know, why are squids so genetically related? What caused the bottleneck? What's sort of the timing of when all this happened? There's just a lot of new mysteries created by this study.
It sounds like more genetic studies are needed in order to...
Right. And because they only looked at the mitochondrial DNA, the researchers really wanted to look at the entire DNA of these organisms. And that's a project that's currently underway.
Great. So what else is on the site this week, Dave?
Well, Sarah, we've got a story about predicting landslides. Also a story about the next generation of high-tech televisions. These are televisions that are 3D, but you don't have to wear the funky glasses. For Science Insider, our policy blog, we've got a story about an anthrax vaccine trial that's about to be started in children. Also a story about the future of energy research in the United States. Finally, for Science Live, our weekly chat on the hottest topics in science, this week's Science Live is about the next plague. 10 years after SARS, what are the new viral threats that are emerging around the globe? Next week's Science Live is about conservation strategies. Are they working or are they causing more harm than good? So be sure to check out all these stories on the site.
Thanks, Dave.
Thanks, Sarah.
David Grimm is the editor for Science's online daily news site. You can check out the latest news and the policy blog, Science Insider, at news.sciencemag.org, where you can also join a live chat, Science Live, on the hottest science topics every Thursday at 3 p.m. U.S. Eastern Time.
And that concludes the March 22nd, 2013 edition of the Science Podcast.
If you have any comments or suggestions for the show, please write us at sciencepodcast@aaas.org.
The show is a production of Science Magazine. Jeffrey Cook composed the music. I'm Carrie Klein.
And I'm Sarah Crespi. On behalf of Science Magazine and its publisher, AAAS, thanks for joining us.